Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, March 12th, 2024. I'm your reader, Denise. On the front page, final lane opening on interchange set for April. The Iowa DOT contractors pour concrete for medians on I-380 this month by Aaron Jordan, the Gazette. Many motorists still are enjoying the novelty of all ramps being open at the new Interstate 80 interchange with 380. Largely completed in August, but there still is work going on the massive roadway reconfiguration. Contractors this month are pouring concrete for median barriers on I-380 near where it becomes Highway 218. The I-80 median barrier was completed in mid-January and a temporary barrier was removed in early February, said Hugh Holock, resident construction engineer for the Iowa Department of Transportation's District 6, which includes Linn and Johnson counties. Once done, we have rumble strips to install on the median shoulder on both I-80 and I-380, Holock wrote in an email. Then also, in late April, we'll have to add one more lane both directions on the left side of I-380, US 218. Once all the lanes are open, the Iowa DOT or contractors will do finish work, which includes replacing some cracked sections of concrete in active lanes and some right-of-way fence, Holock said. Most of the work will be done by the end of April. Some minor work continuing in the fall won't interfere with traffic, he said. The Iowa DOT offered contractors nearly $5.4 million in incentives to meet early deadlines related to closed ramps and other closures. For example, the ramp to and from 218 going south was supposed to be done before November 17, 2023, but the ramp was opened months earlier on August 30th, Holock said. These deadlines were all achieved, he said. The state did not provide incentives for median barriers or connected projects such as paving Jasper Avenue west of I-380. The $387 million interchange project, which started in 2018, replaced the Cloverleaf intersection four loops with directional ramps. Contractors widened I-80 on both sides of the interchange, I-380 north of I-80 and Highway 218 south of I-80. The changes will make a typical trip 35% more reliable and reduce traffic delays by 64 million hours over the next 30 years, Iowa DOT leaders said during a ribbon-cutting ceremony in August. Also part of the multi-year project was extending the Clear Creek Trail under the interchange. The quarter mile of new concrete helps cyclists connect with the trail systems that eventually will go from Iowa City to F.W. Kent Park west of Tiffin. The Iowa DOT's portion of the trail cost $186,720. Time running out for Iowa lawmakers to advance major bills. In the balance, changes to the state's AEAs, gender identity, and school safety by Aaron Murphy and Tom Barton. With a second key deadline looming at the week's end in the Iowa legislature, there remain many significant proposals with work still to do in just a few days if they are to remain available for further consideration in this year's session. Defining man and woman in state law, helping schools arm teachers and other staff, creating legal penalties for causing a pregnancy to end, which also could impact fertility treatments. These are just a few high-profile proposals needing at least a little more legislative approval if they are to remain on track to become law this year. Even the one issue that has dominated the 2024 session like no other, Governor Kim Reynolds' proposal to overhaul the way the state's nine area education agencies are operated and funded, still needs legislative attention by the end of this week. All of these proposals and hundreds more face the second legislative deadline of the 2024 second session, the second funnel. By the end of this week, legislation must be approved by one full chamber, either the Iowa House or Senate, and at least a committee in the opposite chamber in order to remain eligible for consideration moving forward. Any bill that fails to garner that much legislative support would be considered dead. However, leaders in the majority party have the ability to resurrect the dead bills through multiple legislative tools, and sometimes they do. The funnel deadline does not apply to bills that deal with tax policy, the state budget, or other spending measures. So bills that deal with, for example, increasing the salaries of public school teachers and support staff, Reynolds proposed streamlining of the state's mental and behavioral health systems, or State House Republicans' plans to further decrease state income taxes are not subject to this week's deadline. The following bills and topics are among the many the state lawmakers must advance at some point this week if the bills are to survive this second funnel. Area education agencies. In her January 9th condition of the state address to the Iowa legislature, Reynolds set the tone for the next 4 months when she called for dramatic changes to the operating and funding structures of Iowa's area education agencies. Since that day, Reynolds has unveiled her proposal and offered changes after hearing feedback from educators and parents, and majority party Republicans in the Iowa Senate and Iowa House have introduced their own proposals. Instead of allowing state funding to go directly to the AEAs, as is currently the case, Reynolds has proposed giving school districts more direct control over special education funding and moving oversight of AEAs to the state education department instead of local boards. Senate Republicans' proposal is similar to the governor's, but keeps some of the state funding moving straight to the AEAs and calls for the Iowa Department of Education to work with the AEAs on a new oversight structure. House Republicans went on a completely different route. The House bill keeps AEAs as the sole provider of special education support. While state funding for special education services would go to the school districts, schools would be required to use that funding on services provided by the AEAs. House Republicans passed their plan out of the chamber, barely, on a 53-41 vote, with 9 Republicans voting against it. Shortly after the House's passage, the Senate was scheduled to debate the bill, but in an unusual move, it was pulled from the debate calendar and has not been there since. Gender identity. Legislation proposed by Reynolds that would define man and woman in Iowa code based on a person's sex assigned at birth has yet to advance out of the House. House Republicans passed the bill out of committee last month over the protests of transgender Iowans and civil rights activists who called it discriminatory, arguing it would lead to erasure of transgender and non-binary people from Iowa code. But lawmakers have yet to take up the bill on the House floor and send it off to the Senate. House File 2389 defines man and woman and several other terms in Iowa code based on a person's sex assigned at birth. The bill would also allow transgender people to become excluded from sex-segregated spaces such as bathrooms and women's shelters. It would also require transgender Iowans to list both their sex assigned at birth and their post-transition sex on their birth certificate. Reynolds and Republicans said women and men possessed unique biological differences and that the bill was necessary to protect the health, safety, and rights of women in spaces such as domestic violence shelters and rape crisis centers. However, both the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault and Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence have registered opposed to the bill. LGBTQ and civil rights advocates said the bill is another attack on transgender Iowans, and its use of pro-segregation language should raise alarm. It says the term equal does not mean same, and that separate accommodations are not inherently unequal. School safety and arming teachers. A bill to create a licensing process for K-12 school staff to carry guns on campus has yet to advance out of Senate committee to remain eligible after this week's funnel. House Republicans passed the proposal along party lines in February. The bill was proposed in the wake of January's fatal shooting at Perry High School. Republicans hope the bill, House File 2586, would make insurance companies less resistant to covering a school that allows its teachers and staff to carry firearms, which is already legal under Iowa law. Democrats have opposed the proposal and say that introducing more guns to school grounds will not make students safer. The bill also would devote state funds to allow large schools to hire private security officers or school resource officers. A Senate subcommittee advanced the bill last week, sending it to the full Education Committee. It must pass out of the committee to remain eligible after this week. Fetal homicide and fertility treatments. House Republicans introduced and passed out of the chamber a proposal they said would increase penalties for individuals whose actions cause a pregnancy to be terminated. But House Democrats warned about the legislation because it also replaces the state law, the terms human pregnancy with unborn person, could jeopardize fertility treatments for families hoping to get pregnant. During debate in the Iowa House, Democrats argued the proposed legislation could make in vitro fertilization illegal because as part of that process, extra embryos are sometimes frozen, destroyed, or discarded. House File 2575 passed the House but has not yet been taken up by the Senate. Bill to help Iowa's nursing homes manage cost advances by Aaron Murphy. A proposal to cap what staffing agencies call charge for the help of temporary health care workers, which Iowa's nursing homes turn to as a means of addressing employee shortages, is being considered by state lawmakers. The proposal supporters say staffing agencies charge so much for temporary nurses that it places a financial burden on nursing homes and other health care facilities. But the proposal also has been met with caution from staffing agencies, which insist that billing rates that spiked during COVID-19 pandemic have gradually returned to pre-pandemic levels, and warn that capping rates would only make healthcare worker shortages even worse. Under the proposal, payment rates for nursing services provided by staffing agencies could be no more than 150% of the statewide average paid by the previous year. The proposal was introduced by majority Republicans in the Iowa House and passed out of that chamber with strong bipartisan support. It is now being considered in the Iowa Senate, where the proposal went through its first legislative hearing in that chamber Monday at the Iowa Capitol. The stress in the long-term care industry is very real. I think everybody understands it, said Senator Jason Schultz, a Republican from Schleswig, who ran the subcommittee hearing Monday, told reporters after the meeting, I do believe we are going to have a very robust exchange of ideas on this one, but that indicates just how much money is at stake and on hand and how difficult the long-term care industry is on the other. Iowa's nursing homes are losing money. Had it already been in place, the proposed legislation would save the industry $22 million this year, according to the testimony of Brent Wilson, president and chief executive officer of the Iowa Healthcare Association. Those dollars could be reinvested in increasing wages for permanent direct care staff, hiring more people, and not directed predominantly to out-of-state staffing agency profit margins, Willett said during the meeting. But the proposal could have the opposite of its intended impact, argued Bob Livonius, chair of the American Staffing Association and board member of Grape Tree Medical Staffing based in Milford. Livonius said nearly two-thirds of nurses who work through staffing agencies have other full-time jobs, and that those nurses could be driven out of staffing positions if the proposed legislation becomes law. He said that would create even more strain on nursing homes when they look to staffing agencies when in need of temporary workers. The organization that represents Iowa nurses shared that concern during the hearing. I will say nurses feel very targeted by this. There was a very negative reaction to this legislation, said Amy Campbell, a lobbyist for the Iowa Nurses Association. There are other traveling professions that have similar profit margins that are not included in this. So they felt very pulled out and targeted, and they have deep concerns that this is actually going to have the opposite effect. Senator Todd Taylor, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, said his viewpoint on the proposed legislation has gone back and forth. I spoke with a lot of people last week. I was for the bill. I was against the bill, Taylor said, and this is not with any snark at all. But many of the bills that I've seen in legislature, there's not really a problem that we're fixing. Here, I see there is a problem. I am concerned. Is this the right fix? The bill, House File 2391, previously passed the Iowa House on an 80-17 vote. Schleswig and fellow Republican Senator Don Driscoll from Williamsburg advanced it out of subcommittee Monday, making it eligible for consideration by the full Senate Workforce Committee. Schultz said the goal is to at least pass the bill out of that committee in order for it to qualify for this week's legislative deadline and remain eligible for consideration. And also on the front page, construction underway on Marion's fourth hotel. Holiday Inn Express and Suites will be part of Easttown Crossing Project. By Marissa Payne, The Gazette, Marion. The future operator of a new Holiday Inn Express and Suites being built in the East Marion on the site of the city's first large-scale mixed-use development anticipates opening doors to guests by the end of the year. Cora Lahr, Chief Operating Officer for Omaha-based Hart Family Hotels, the future hotel operator that currently manages six Iowa hotels, said Monday that construction started late last fall at Easttown Crossing, formerly named Squaw Creek Crossing, located at Highways 13 and 151. It will be Marion's fourth hotel. "We're grateful for the project because it helps to meet a big need in our city," Mayor Nick Abu Asali said in a statement. "Experts have told us that the city, the size of Marion, can support several more hotels. As our city grows and becomes more of a destination, especially with the developing sports tourism, we need additional hotel space to accommodate visitors and provide them with the opportunity to stay right here in Marion. Easttown Crossing, which began development in 2017, contains more than 20 acres, including retail, commercial, hospitality, and residential projects. The development already hosts businesses including Quickstar, DePaco Credit Union, Poncheros, Jersey Mike's Subs, Pizza Ranch, and The Mac, Scooter's Coffee, and a Daisy's Garage restaurant. Some multifamily rentals already online and with the proposed of a third building. Hotel would be Marion's fourth. Lars said crews are framing the hotel's fourth floor as much as the exterior is up. She said crews soon will start on stonework outside and part of the parking lot is poured. Plumbing and electrical work is taking place throughout the property. Windows will be installed this week and the roof likely will be added in the next few weeks. Once completed, the 93-unit hotel will offer a variety of room types with 55-inch TVs and amenities including a swimming pool, fitness room, and breakfast. Family hotel owner Troy Hart said the hotel's development is being fueled by overnight guests being drawn by the Prospect Meadows Sport Complex nearby, the Easttown Crossings development offering an array of amenities, and the proximity to highways at that location. "We're super excited to get open and serve Marion and the guests," Hart said. With only three other hotels in Marion, Hart said his company felt Marion was underdeveloped in hotels, as most demand goes to northern Cedar Rapids. Several hotels are located on Collins Road Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Marion's other hotels are Town Place Suites by Marion, Marriott, and Marion Hotel, both on 7th Avenue, and Microtel Inn and Suites by Wyndham Marion, Cedar Rapids, on Dyer Avenue. A city with Marion's population typically would have 7 to 10 hotels, but it's easier for developers to choose Cedar Rapids, Hart said. His company hopes to potentially build another hotel in Marion in the coming years. Hotel spurs interest in remaining lots. Last week, Marion Finance Director Leanne Carey said with the hotel under construction, the overall site's developer, Easttown Crossings, Inc., brought forth a request to assign a development agreement for the hotel site to the Hart Family Hotels. The City Council approved that Thursday. This comes after the city last year changed its agreement with the developer of Easttown Crossing to split one agreement into three, including a separate agreement with the hotel developer. In 2019, hotel construction was estimated at $11 million, but when the developer applied for public incentives, costs spiked to $17.5 million, with business travel down through 2022 as a result of the pandemic. Council documents stated the short-term reduction in revenue has great impact on our ability to attract qualified equity investors. The modified agreement, approved last April by the Marion City Council, removed the hotel lot and three lots with no projects identified. Those unbuilt lots were placed under a memorandum of understanding for possible future action as project plans firm up. It also extended the new government to a maximum of 20 years at a 50% tax increment financing rebate if the hotel is built. Marion reduced its incentives from $9.6 million to $7.5 million based on updated estimates for the development. The new agreement specifically for the hotel with developer Braveheart Development, in partnership with Hart Family Hotels, provided a five-year tax incentive for 90% of the increased value of the project generates, and another 5 years at 50%, at most a value of $1.5 million. Under the third agreement for the unbuilt lots on East Town Crossing, terms include 12-year sliding scale incentive with a maximum incentive of $2.1 million. Mike Esker, associate real estate broker for Coldwell Banker Hedges, said the recent focus has been on hotel construction. There are no specific plans yet for these unbuilt lots, he said, but the activity out here has attracted more attention and interest. Those lots included a corner lot next to DePaco, land next to Daisy's Garage, and a lot in front of the hotel. There are interested parties and groups that have reached out to us and that are discussing the remaining lots with, Esker said. In Iowa Today, Davenport sues state auditor in probe of city's settlement deals. Davenport paid out $1.9 million to settle harassment claims made by city officials by Clark Kaufman. Iowa Capital Dispatch. The city of Davenport is taking the state auditor to court over an investigation into $1.9 million in settlements paid out to former city employees. The city is opposing a subpoena that Iowa Auditor of State Rob Sand has issued for records related to conversations that Davenport city officials had with staff attorneys and contracted attorneys over actual or potential litigation related to the settlements. Sand's subpoena calls for the city to produce closed session minutes and recordings of five city council or committee of the whole meetings, as well as copies of all emails and memos discussing proposed settlements with former city administrator Corey Spiegel and two city assistants, Samantha Torres and Tiffany Thorndike. The subpoena also demands access to the three individuals' employment agreements and to the final signed settlements between the city and the three. Last November, shortly after a city election had taken place, Davenport city officials announced they had agreed before the election to pay Spiegel, who already was planning to leave her job with the city, $1.6 million due to some form of prolonged and documented instances of harassment by unidentified elected officials. The payouts to Thorndike and Torres, totaling $297,500, also are tied to the unspecified allegations of harassment. Since the settlements were announced, concerns have been raised that some city council members may have supported the use of taxpayer money to dispose of legal claims that stem from their own behavior or the behavior of their fellow council members. In response to the state auditor's demand for access to records, the city has gone to court and asked a judge to modify the subpoena to exclude all of the recordings and minutes of the closed session council and committee discussions, arguing that they absolutely covered by attorney-client privilege since they involved discussions of settlements with the city's attorneys. The auditor, in turn, has told the court that Iowa law specifically provides that the office, when conducting any audit or review, shall at all times have access to all information, records, instrumentalities, and proprieties used in the performance of the audited or reviewed entities, statutory duties, or contractual responsibilities. The auditor notes that the law also dictates that if the records at issue are confidential, the auditor's office shall have access to them, with the understanding that it must maintain the confidentiality of the records once it has gained access to them. A court hearing on the dispute is scheduled for March 25th. Last month, in separate but related court proceedings, the Iowa Freedom of Information Council intervened in litigation over the city's refusal to comply with public records requests for a letter from Spiegel that allegedly outlines her allegations against the city. The city has asked the court to rule on whether it can make the letter public. This article first appeared in the Iowa Capital Dispatch. To secure permission to reprint the Gazette article, send a letter explaining what you'd like to reprint and how it's to be used to reprint editor the Gazette, 116 3rd Street Southeast, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 52401. For sale, UNI frat house with 24 bedrooms but few members. House listed at over $1.2 million and presents a redevelopment opportunity by Andy Malone, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. A large fraternity house is available to purchase for over $1.2 million in a prominent spot on the outskirts of the University of Northern Iowa campus. Sigma Alpha Epsilon brothers, who still live in the 14,122 square foot building at 1115 West 23rd Street, said that membership numbers and finances had to do with deciding to the right size and move on from the house. Two-story house dates to 1998 and takes up a sizable portion of the block. It's known by passerbys as the building with two white lion statues out front. It also has a purple roof and an emblem blinking with multiple colors. Back then, when we built the building, we were near 100 members. But you've seen what happens to a university enrollment, and we've have similar reductions, said Robert Lee, president of Iowa Chapters House Corporation, which owns the building. That's led to a situation where the fraternity essentially had to force members to live there, and even so, the chapter has open beds. Everyone now has to live in it, but not everyone wants to live in it together, said Lee. He said the housing corporation is doing really well financially, but you don't cash flow without every member living there to pay rent to cover expenses such as utilities, upkeep, and property taxes. Fall and spring 2023 academic reports available on UNI's website had the chapter membership at 24 and 29 respectively, down from a spring 2022 total of 42. The oldest available report from spring 2013 had membership at 59. The members will continue to live at the house through late May, and hopefully by then the sale will be finalized, Lee said. Members will be on their own for housing the next academic year, but Lee is confident that in the future the chapter will identify smaller living quarters, possibly for less than 10 members, maybe just officers, in order for some brothers to live together. Sigma Alpha Epsilon, known as SAE, hosts its annual Patty Murphy Week philanthropy in the springtime and has more than 220 chapters nationwide. A Facebook post from November 15, 2015 noted the day as marking the 100th anniversary of the fraternity at UNI and the 50th anniversary as a Sigma Alpha Epsilon chapter after being originally founded as the Alpha Chi Epsilon Fraternity. The January 22nd real estate listing, first reported by the Northern Iowan, labels the building as being capable of housing 48 people and the half acre as a redevelopment opportunity for potentially multifamily housing or a religious campus-related purpose. The asking price recently dropped from $1.3 million to $1.225 million. A city database indicates about 9 rental properties immediately to the north and west surround the fraternity house. The St. Stephen the Witness Catholic Student Center is next door, and the university's parking ramp is nearby. The university is not forcing them to sell, and the fraternity chapter, one of only two recognized by the institution in its 2023 reports versus the four in 2013, is not facing any disciplinary action. According to Josh Ferris, UNI's fraternity and sorority life coordinator, we're doing what makes sense for them, Ferris said. They're still an active fraternity, and we will continue to support them whether they have a house or not. He said UNI is not really involved in fraternity housing decisions, especially when it involves a private building, and therefore could not provide additional details. The real estate listing said the house has 24 bedrooms, a kitchenette, library, recreation room, breakfast area, lounge, other common area space, and walkout level, and the back with a 27-vehicle parking lot. We've gotten serious interest, said Matt Mee, the official's commercial and residential group broker, handling the listing when reached by telephone. UNI is not interested in buying the property at this time, a spokesperson and Lee said. Mice declined to name the possible suitors. Lee says demolition, or in his words, starting over, hasn't been discussed. It was a very hard decision. Nobody wanted it to come to this, but everyone agrees that it had to happen, said Lee. Plan B was recruiting more members, and that just wasn't going to happen. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, March 12th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. William Bill Leroy Stedman, 90, of Marion, passed from this life on Thursday, March 7th, 2024, at St. Luke's Hospital. Visitation will be held from 12 noon to 1 p.m., with the funeral service to follow on Wednesday, March 13th, at Cedar Memorial in Cedar Rapids. The Reverend Kevin T. Jones will officiate. Private family interment will be in Oak Shade Cemetery, Marion. Marlis R. Savari, age 89, of Iowa City, died Saturday, March 9th, 2024, at Oak Knoll Retirement Residence. Memorial services will be held 11 a.m. Thursday, March 14th, 2024, at Gloria Day Lutheran Church in Iowa City, where visitation will begin at 10 a.m. until service time. Burial will take place at the Ringsaker Cemetery in Pelican Rapids, Minnesota, at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made in her memory to Gloria Day Lutheran Church or to the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation or Savari Family Intern Fund. Dennis Lee Pettit, 68, of Cedar Rapids, joined his Savior in heaven Saturday, March 2nd, 2024. Friends may visit with the family Saturday, March 17th, 2024, from 3 to 6 o'clock p.m. at New Covenant Bible Church and at 10 a.m. on Monday. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Monday, March 18th, 2024, at New Covenant Bible Church. Burial will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery at 2 p.m. Joseph Joe Leo Glazer, age 92, of New Hampton, died Friday, March 8, 2024, at his home surrounded by his family. Mass of Christian burial will be held 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March 13, 2024, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in North Washington with celebrants Reverend Kenneth Glazer, son, and Reverend Ryan Glazer, grandson. Interment will follow at St. Mary's Cemetery, North Washington. Shirley J. Myers, 88, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, went to be with the Lord on Sunday, March 10, 2024. The family will host a celebration of life at a later date. A memorial fund has been established and the proceeds will be directed to the family. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids assists the family. Loretta E. Mullenhauer, 90, of Marion, Iowa, died Sunday, March 10th, 2024, at Windmill Manor in Coralville, Iowa. A private family graveside service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park service. Kathleen Kathy Frances Thole, 68, of Manchester, Iowa, passed away peacefully surrounded by her loving family Sunday, March 10th, 2024, at her home following her courageous battle with cancer. Online condolences may be sent to www.leonard-mullerfh.com. Mass of Christian burial, 11 a.m. on Thursday, March 14th, 2024, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Manchester, Iowa, with Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Scripture service, 2:30 p.m. on Wednesday, March 13th, 2024, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester, Iowa. Visitation, 3 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 13th, 2024, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester, Iowa. Friends may also call at the church on Thursday from 9:45 a.m. to 10:45 a.m. Catholic daughters will recite the rosary at the church before Mass. Interment, St. Mary Catholic Cemetery, Manchester, Iowa. Shirley Mae Jones, 80, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Friday, March 8, 2024, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, March 14, 2024, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories Stateroom. A private graveside service will be held at a later date. Ronald Ron Douglas Bossler, 78, of Vinton, died on March 9, 2024, at his home with his wife of 56 years holding his hand and surrounded by family. Visitation will be Thursday, March 14th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Phillips Funeral Home Chapel, 212 East 6th Street in Vinton. The family will hold a graveside service at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be directed to the family or Venmo at BOSSLERA. Daniel Sean DeReich, 60, of Victor, Iowa, passed away on March 8, 2024, at Compass Memorial Hospital, Marengo, Iowa. A funeral mass of the resurrection will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, March 14, 2024, at St. Bridget Catholic Church, Victor, Iowa, with burial at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will take place from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 13th at Smith Funeral Home, Victor, Iowa, with a rosary service at 3 p.m. in lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be directed to the Dan DeReich Memorial Fund and mailed in care of Smith Funeral Home, P.O. Box 485, Victor, Iowa, 50112. Dan Smith, 70, of Solon, passed away on Sunday, March 10, 2024, in his home. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 15, 2024, at St. Mary's Catholic Church. Funeral service will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 16, 2024, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Solon. Burial will be in Oakland Cemetery, Solon. Brosh Chapel and the Abba Center in Solon is in charge of arrangements. Carrie B. Weaver, Smyrna, Tennessee. On Wednesday, March 6, 2024, Carrie passed away peacefully at the age of 68 after a brief battle with cancer. As her final wish, in place of a service, Carrie has asked for one final act of kindness to be passed on, to donate to a pet rescue, LGBTQ plus program, or women's support service locations of your choosing. Beverly Jean Lynch, 91, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Friday, March 8, 2024, at St. Luke's Helen G. Nassif Transitional Center, Care Center in Cedar Rapids. Visitation is from 12 to 1 p.m. Saturday, March 16, 2024, at Community of Christ Church, 1500 Blair's Ferry Road in Hiawatha. Funeral service, 1 p.m. Saturday, March 16, 2024, at Community of Christ Church in Hiawatha. Internment, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is assisting the family. Don Harmon, 87, died peacefully Saturday morning, March 9, 2024, at his home. Funeral services will be held 10:30 Friday morning, March 15, 2024, at St. Paul Lutheran Church, Anamosa. Pastor Rodney Blummel will officiate at the service. Visitation will be held from 4 until 8 Thursday evening at the Gosch Family Home, Anamosa. Thoughts, memories, and condolences may be left at www.goschonline.com. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Alzheimer's Association or the St. Paul Lutheran Church. John Jack F. Sloan, 81, formerly of Hiawatha, Iowa, passed away Friday, March 8, 2024, at his home in Apple Valley, Minnesota. Funeral services will be held Friday, March 15th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be from 1 to 2 p.m., with services to begin at 2 p.m. at the funeral home. Neil Edward Paulson, 95, passed away on Saturday, March 9th, 2024, at the Monticello Nursing and Rehab. His family has granted his wishes of a private graveside service at the Clay Cemetery in rural Onslow. On the Insight page, from Asitha Jayawardena, syndicated columnist, Dear Caitlin Clark, thank you. Dear Caitlin Clark, recently I was lucky enough to see you play in person. I brought my 5-year-old daughter to Williams Arena in Minneapolis, where I live now with my wife and 2 girls. You dominated as usual and were playing at a different level than anyone else on the court. The shots you were making reminded me of when I would play NBA video games and on the cheat mode. To be honest, we really don't have much in common. I'm a first-generation Sri Lankan immigrant, and my parents didn't really know much about American sports, so I found my own path. I really watched a VHS tape with a documentary I found of Michael Jordan and was amazed by him. I joined my middle school basketball team. I was terrible. On my best day, on a full stretch, I'm a whopping 5'4". In late middle school, I discovered tennis. I was good, not great, but I harnessed the energy of MJ and learned how to outwork and out-hustle my opponents and ended up playing a high school and college. I learned a lot of life lessons from sports along the way, and I told myself I would teach my kids how to play sports early on so they wouldn't be playing catch-up like me. Fast forward a few years, and I now am the proud dad to 2 girls. For the first few years of our short little lives, my work prevented me from spending as much time as I wanted with them. I've been intentional about building my relationships to these absolute gems of human, but at first it was hard to connect. I played dress-up and dolls and let them paint my fingernails, all of which they loved, but Mommy was always better at it. We started regular daddy-daughter dates to help foster our relationship. My youngest daughter was an easygoing egg to crack. We both love cinnamon rolls and have regular daddy-daughter dates exploring various cinnamon roll shops around the Twin Cities. My eldest daughter has been a little more complex. It took a while, but I found my cheat code, Caitlin Clark. Our daddy-daughter dates occur whenever you play. We sit back, relax, and watch you dominate. I see the same transformation in her as I did in myself when I first learned of the grit and tenacity that was like Mike. Together, I've watched my daughter's confidence soar as we have learned about how practice helps you get better, how to be a good teammate, and how sometimes we win and sometimes we lose, but we always try our best. I spent an outrageous amount of money to see you in person with my 5-year-old daughter. You were electric as usual, and we jumped and danced and cheered. At one point, my daughter leaned over to me and said, "She hits that shot in the game because she works on it a lot in practice, right, Daddy?" It was worth every penny. You even graciously stuck around and signed our jerseys at the end of the game. I said, "Thank you. You're amazing." I wanted to say so much more, but there were hundreds of other little girls with their moms and dads waiting to see you. Allow me to try one more time now that the throngs of adoring fans are gone. Dear Caitlin Clark, if you read this, I want to say thank you. Thank you for being an electrifying, transcendent athlete who is actively changing the world of sports, but mostly thank you for helping me be a better dad. Dr. Asitha Jayawardena is a pediatric ENT surgeon at Children's Minnesota. In the community letters, GOP wants its own brand of indoctrination. When I attended Perkins Elementary School in Des Moines in the mid-1960s, we began every school day standing at attention for reveille played through the school PA. We then pledged allegiance to the flag. Our teachers assured us the United States was the richest, most powerful nation on earth. We were told the policeman is your friend. In music classes, we sang Christmas carols every year. I stopped pledging the flag when I was 13 because I opposed U.S. military intervention in Vietnam. I simply stood silently. Our 8th grade history teacher screened the CIA-sponsored animated film Animal Farm, along with the 1950s-era anti-communist propaganda. She wondered if Chilean President Salvador Allende would peacefully surrender power, something she assured us no Marxist had ever done. Allende was killed in a 1973 coup by the Chilean military. There is no irony when right-wingers denounce indoctrination in public schools. They want schools to indoctrinate students with their, to borrow the phrase from George Orwell, smelly orthodoxies. Iowa Republicans have obviously never heard of the U.S. Supreme Court decision, West Virginia versus Barnett. The court ruled requiring students to pledge the flag violated their First Amendment rights. The Barnett girls refused to recite the pledge because it violated their Jehovah's Witness belief against idolatry. Iowa Republicans need to end their ignorance of the law and what is just and stop pandering to the petty resentments of their party base. Govern for us all, not just the fanatics. Jeff Klinsman, Corville. Educators do not need guns. Educators need a lot of things. They need adequate, on-time school funding, parental support, dedicated school boards, administrators who will back them, supplies, adequate preparation time, professional pay, positive working conditions, technology, and a legislature that supports public schools. They don't need guns. House File 2652 was originally a $3 million grant program to purchase emergency radios for schools, but gun-loving legislators amended the bill to focus on firearms training, paying for the gun permitting process, stipends for employees agreed to be arms, and for purchase of the weapons. Ironically, Republicans have refused to follow the law by passing state supplemental aid for schools on time, forcing schools to guess for another month about funding. Buying guns for educators is a higher priority. It's irresponsible. Also, House File 2586, the bill authorizing arming school employees, recently advanced to the full Education Committee in the Senate. There are at least 4 reasons these 2 bills are terrible ideas. Insurance companies will have options. Spirit Lake and Cherokee school boards voted to do this last year. Their insurance companies vetoed the idea by dropping insurance company coverage. The new idea in House File 2586 seeks to avoid that problem by requiring training for armed staff and giving districts and employees qualified immunity from criminal and civil liability. That move may keep insurance companies from dropping coverage, but it won't keep them from raising liability premiums. These are risk-averse private entities. Educators trained and permitted won't stop companies from assessing the risk and cashing in. We haven't learned. We haven't learned anything from the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Trained law enforcement cowered against one man with an assault weapon. Unless schools plan to issue AR-15s to educators, they'll be outgunned. There are ways to secure schools, but it'll take more than $25,000 grants and inadequate state supplemental aid. There are no secrets. Students will know who's armed and where the guns are stored. That means angry students could also have access to guns. Another secret is the quickest to volunteer to be armed are often educators who you don't want to be armed. They might be the ones seeking the prestige and power that may come with it. Overreactions could be deadly. Most educators can de-escalate violent situations, but there are exceptions. If guns are involved, the situation could turn deadly instead of just ugly. A community would be hard-pressed to recover from an educator killing a student in the heat of a moment or completely by accident. It would be awful if innocent lives were lost because legislators pandered to their base about guns. Mass shootings might be fueled by a combination of causes like mental health issues or poor parenting, but refusing to acknowledge easy access to guns as part of the problem is refusing to face reality. Guns don't belong in school. Bruce Lear lives in Sioux City, taught in public schools for 11 years, and represented educators as the Iowa State Education Association Regional Director for 27 years until retiring. Guest editorial, Congress must act on broadband. The U.S. has lately gotten serious about broadband expansion, with the federal government spending tens of billions of dollars to deploy services all over the country, especially in rural areas where coverage is sparse. But how widely connectivity is available matters little if consumers can't afford it. And unless Congress acts fast, many won't be able to. The Affordable Connectivity Program came into being under the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act of 2021 after the coronavirus pandemic forced many to work, learn, and even socialize from computers at home. The benefit, $30 per month, is reaching 23 million households. Most had inconsistent service beforehand or no service at all. The program's funding will lapse by the end of April because Congress has managed neither to devise a permanent solution nor to provide stopgap funding. A bipartisan group of legislators devised the $7 billion Affordability Connectivity Program Extension Act, but House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican Louisiana, has refused to bring it to the floor. The government has a role in ensuring that every American has access to critical infrastructure, which broadband has become. Without internet access, residents have a harder time setting up healthcare appointments, finding jobs, completing schoolwork, and more. According to Cigna Healthcare, patients who use virtual care save an average of $93 for a non-urgent visit online compared with an in-person trip and an average of $141 at a virtual urgent clinic. Easy use of the internet smooths the way to completing schoolwork, finding a job, and communicating with social services. All of these lead to savings to reducing the need for and use of government benefits. The Commerce Department is enmeshed in the slow but steady process of reviewing state plans to bring the internet to areas underserved by today's networks. This broadband equity access and deployment program has $42.5 billion ready to ensure that providers build in rural areas by offering them subsidies to do so. If providers know there's something like the Affordable Connectivity Program, that will attract consumers, underserved markets will look more attractive. None of this is to say the program is perfect. There's room for revisions. Johnson should tell us what changes could persuade him to bring the extension to the floor. In sports, boys All-State basketball, Tri-Rivers Stars shine on off court. North Lynn, Maquoketa Valley Have All-Staters by Jeff Johnson. The Tri-Rivers Conference was pretty good in boys basketball this season. Both teams that played in the Class 1A state championship game were league members. That'd be North Lynn and Bellevue Marquette. Three players from the Tri-Rivers are first-team All-Staters in the class according to the Iowa Professional Sports Writers Association, which has released its entire 4A All-State teams. They were picked by a combination of media members and head coaches from across the state. The Tri-Rivers trio is senior Lance McShane of Maquoketa Valley, senior Ty Flugoft of North Lynn, and junior Mason Becken of North Lynn. Marquette junior Spencer Roeder was picked for a 1A second team. Nine players from the Gazette area are first teamers: McShane, Flugoff, and Becken, Davis Kern of Lynn Mar, and Trey McCowan of Cedar Rapids Kennedy in Class 4A, Ben Bachman of Decorah, and Derek Weiskopf of Williamsburg in 3A, and Preston Reese of Monticello, and Holden Arneman of West Branch in 2A. Jesse Van Calsbeek of MOC Floyd Valley is the 2024 Iowa Mr. Basketball. McShane is better known for his football prowess. He's also an all-stater in that sport, but averaged 18 points and 9.4 rebounds per game this season for the Maquoketa Valley Hoops team. The 6'3" forward led the Wildcats to a 19-5 season. Flugoff and Becken were the main 1-2 punch for North Lynn team that made it to the state title game for an unprecedented 7th consecutive year. The school won its third state championship, 57-56, over Marquette. A 6'5" forward headed to Upper Iowa University, Flugoff averaged 19.2 points, 6.4 rebounds, 2.7 assists, and 2.5 steals per game. Becken, a 6'1 guard, averaged 21.3 points, 4.2 rebounds, 5.6 assists, and 3 steals. The captain of the 1A all-tournament team at state, he averaged 27 points, 7.7 rebounds, and 4.3 assists in North Lynn's 3 games, most of the time unstoppable when he drove through the lane to the basket. "If he's not scoring, he's creating shots for other people," said North Lynn guard Brecklin Bettenbender. "I don't know if there's anybody in the state that's capable of guarding him one-on-one." Reese is a 2-time first-team All-State selection in 2A. The 6'2 senior who has signed to play football at the University of Iowa averaged 26.4 points, 10.4 rebounds, and 2.6 assists for a Monticello team that was ranked by the Iowa High School Athletic Association all season and finished 18-3. The 6'3 Arneman is headed to Division II Minnesota State. The guard averaged 23.7 points, 6.2 rebounds, and 4.5 assists per game for a West Branch team that won its division in the River Valley Conference. The 6'5 wing Bachman helped Decorah to the state tournament for the second time in 3 years, an all-tournament pick for the Vikings, who lost to champion Davenport Assumption in overtime in the semifinals. Bachman averaged 20.1 points, 4.8 rebounds, and 3.8 assists this season. Williamsburg Weiskopf is a 2-year first-team All-Stater. The 6'4 senior, also an Iowa football signee. He helped the Raiders to the state tournament this season by averaging 20.9 points, 7.8 rebounds, and 2.4 assists per game. Kennedy lost to West Des Moines Valley in the 4A championship game and was a very balanced team. That was reflected by Cyrus Courtney being named to the state tournament team and by 3 players named to the All-State team. Junior point guard McCowan had a team-high 17 points in Friday night's state title game. He averaged team-best 13.3 points per game this season, 4.2 assists, and 2.7 steals per game. Joe Bean of the Cougars was selected to the Class 4A second team. Teammate Micah Schlack was a third teamer. Van Calsbeek averaged 20.6 points and 10.8 rebounds for MOCFW, the The 6'3 guard is the second Mr. Basketball who will play at home at NAIA Northwestern College in Orange City, followed by Josh Van Ness in 2005. And that does it for your today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, March 12th, 2024. I'm your reader, Denise. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing. It really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.